Thanks so much, Tom. Thanks, everybody, for coming out, and thanks for your patience with the technical difficulties. I didn't anticipate the Mac to PC business, so I think we have everything going now. And thanks for to Pastor Vince Kolb for opening up this church to this and opening up the church to this conversation.
And by the way, the bathrooms are immediately behind me to the left, and there's a water fountain there. That's all I'm going to say.
Thanks. I might need that at some point. And I also just want to acknowledge that we are all around us on stolen land. This is Haudenosaunee territory, and we are settling on this land, and I think we should remember that. So my biggest fear tonight is that I'm going to have too much to say and not enough time, so if I speak too quickly, I'm just trying to fit it in. So if I need to slow down, just like throw something at me or ask me to repeat something. But because of that also, I think this will work best if we hold questions, comments, vocalized feelings to the end. If you have a very, very short question, point of clarification, you know, fine, raise your hand and I'll try to address it. But otherwise, I think we'll have some time at the end for questions, discussion, commentary. So I'm a geographer by training, so I'm approaching this in part through a lens of geography, through human geography, political geography in particular. I'm also a Christian, and so my approach to Israel-Palestine is through the lens of what I feel God is calling us to do. However, for tonight, I really want to just kind of, as dispassionately as I can, present to you this historical geography of Israel-Palestine, let you decide on those bigger questions of justice and what to do with what you learn. So let's start with the basics. This is Israel-Palestine, Israel and Palestine, Israel-Palestine, Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, Israel and the territories. There are numerous ways to understand and to name and even to border this land. This is a UN map, so this is international law. Under international law, Israel is bound by this green line here, and this area, this is the West Bank, which includes East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, are occupied Palestinian territory. According to international law, they are occupied by the Israeli military. And we'll talk about what that means in a moment. But we have different representations. This is a map that the Israeli government, the Israeli Nature and Parks Authority, made. If you go on a Holy Land trip and you go to one of these sites, you can find a brochure with this map on the back. And you might notice there is no distinction at all in this map between Israel and Palestine, or even Israel and the West Bank. It's all Israel, according to the Israeli government. This is a map that the Palestine State Information Service printed, and everything is Palestine, right? So when we look at geography, we can look at different people's perceptions of geography. We can look at international law. We can look at what different geographies mean to different people. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind. But for tonight, I'm going to stick to international law, the United Nations designation of Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. So just to go to the very basics, Palestinians, generally speaking, are indigenous to this land. Palestinians.
I just wanted to get your request.
That's our sweetie. Thank you.
I'll put it right here for you.
So Palestinians who live in Palestinians who identify with as Palestinians can trace their lineage back hundreds of years legally through oral histories, through written histories. They are considered broadly to be indigenous to this land. Ethnically, Palestinians are Arab, which is a combination of geographic, cultural, linguistic heritage to the Arabian Peninsula and then the spread of people from the Arabian Peninsula. Palestinians, generally the first language is Arabic, although like most places in the world, a lot of people, if not most people, also speak English, among other languages. And Palestinians today live in the occupied West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, inside Israel, and surrounding Arab countries, as well as other places around the world. There's Palestinians in Pittsburgh and in this room. 6 to 7% of the Palestinian population is Christian. And that's the Palestinian population, including the diaspora. Within the West Bank, the Palestinian Christian population is down to about 1 or 2%, I believe. And about 90% are Muslim and mostly Sunni Muslim. Israelis. Most Israelis moved to this land in or after 1948 or descend from migrants to this land. There are indigenous Israelis who are indigenous to this land. Before 1948, they may have identified as Arab Jews. Now they would identify maybe as Mizrahi Jews. But the majority of the population moved to this land either shortly before 1948 or after, or descend from people who did. Most Israelis are Jewish, but not all Israelis are Jewish. About 80% of the population, in fact, is Jewish. Most speak Hebrew, English, Russian, and or other languages. Israel is a multiracial society. You'll see a whole rainbow of humanity among the Israeli population. And Israelis live in Israel and they live in the occupied West Bank. When you hear in the news about Israeli settlers, these are the Israelis who live in the occupied West Bank, and we'll talk about that in a bit as well. So I want to discuss and hopefully dispel three myths about the Israel-Palestine conflict. There are lots of myths, but I think these are three really dominant myths that cloud our perception and sort of common sense and even media coverage. The first myth is that they've been fighting for hundreds of years. Someone I know said this to me, and you know, well, it's in the Bible. They've been fighting for hundreds of years, and often this is used as an excuse for like, well, we're never going to resolve this conflict. But in fact, the modern state of Israel and the people who make up the modern state of Israel and Palestinians have been fighting really only periodically since about 1917. And I'll get to why 1917 in a moment. But there is a long period of coexistence of Christians, Muslims, and Jews in this territory for hundreds of years. And like any place, there have been conflicts, there have been even wars, but if we look at the long stretch of history, peace is more predominant than warfare, and coexistence is more predominant than conflict. And so this modern-day conflict is really, we can date back, some people would date it to 1948, some people would date it back to 1936. I'm dating it to 1917, and I'll explain why a little bit later. The second myth is that it's all about religion, right? That, well, there's Muslims and there's Jews, and they just have different worldviews. It's a clash of civilizations. There's no way they're going to reconcile this. And religion is involved in this conflict, is involved. People are religious, some people fervently religious, some people's politics are driven by their religion and vice versa. That is there, but it is relatively superficial to the underlying themes of the conflict. And in fact, the conflict didn't become as overtly religious as it is now until really about the 1980s. Mm-hmm. Mostly, this conflict is about land and identity. Who gets access to the land? Based on racial identity, based on religious identity, and for some people, religious belief, yes, and religious practice, but it's more about this combination of land and identity. So I am this type of person, so therefore I should have access to that land. Or you are that type of person, therefore this is not your land, this is my land. The third myth is that this is a conflict between equal sides. And if you read the American press, this is how it's presented, at best. At best. And even the word conflict, I think, is a bit of a myth. A conflict is something, you know, like my wife and I sometimes have a conflict over what color we should paint our living room walls. We actually got that resolved, thankfully. It was a mutual compromise, right? But we'll leave aside the definition of conflict and my marriage for the moment. And the myth that I really want to focus on here is this equal sides. Like, no matter how you look at it, there are gross inequalities of power, human rights, and casualties. It is not 100% power on one side and 0% on the other, or 100% human rights and zero on the other, and so forth. Both sides have suffered. Both sides have the power to resist, to exercise that power. And both sides have some set of rights. But as I think will become clear, if it's not already to you, Israel holds disproportionately much more power than Palestine or Palestinians. That's just a fact. Israelis have a full slate of human rights, the same human rights that Americans have here, which, like here, they're not perfect. People have to struggle to keep those rights. Palestinians have far fewer rights, and those rights, we'll get into exactly what those are. And if we look at casualties, which I think there's something dehumanizing about just looking at numbers, but if we do that, I mean, it's astronomically disproportionate in terms of Palestinian deaths, Palestinian injuries, versus Israeli deaths and injuries. And so those are just the facts. It's up to you to decide whether that's just, whether that's fair, whether that was warranted, and what to do about it. So I'm going to start way back in time and fast forward pretty quickly. If we start at around 1030 before the Common Era to about 722 before the Common Era, we have the Kingdom of Israel, David and Solomon. For those of you who are readers of the Old Testament, Hebrew Bible, you're probably familiar with this. This is a map showing David's kingdom and Solomon's kingdom, and this white line is the current outline of the state of Israel. For some Israelis, for some Zionists, this is Israel. This is the quest to return to this land. No one, I think, is really realistically expecting to establish or to stretch the Jewish state up to Iraq, at least not any time in the present or future. But this idea that this was Jewish land, this was the land that God gave Jews, informs some people's politics of modern-day Israel. If we look at... this is where I'm going to really fast forward. Between 700 BCE and 1516 in the Common Era, this land has been ruled by several different empires, Persian, Hellenistic, Roman, various Islamic empires. It's changed hands a lot, and it's led some people to really conclude this land, since about this time, has always been under occupation of some empire. I think one date that is important to point out in relevance to the modern-day Israel-Palestine conflict, 634 in the Common Era. I'm sorry, that's really small for those of you in the back. If you can't see it, just ask me. Islam spread from what is now Saudi Arabia and into much of what we now know as the Middle East, North Africa, into parts of Europe, and including Palestine. This is just a map of showing the spread of the Islamic Caliphate. And this is relevant insofar as this is what brought the Arabic language to the region. This is what brought Islam to the region. This did not mean everyone converted to Islam. There were Christians and Jews and Muslims living in this land together, although after 634, the majority were Muslim. From 1516 to 1917, the land that we call Israel-Palestine, or all of the variations, was ruled by the Ottoman Empire. And we still see evidence of the Ottoman Empire in the architecture there, in some of the actual legal systems, and the legal legacy. The Ottoman Empire, as you know if you studied your high school history, ended around the end of World War I. In 1880, amidst this Ottoman rule, the Zionist movement begins. So what is the Zionist movement? What is Zionism? Basically, this was the movement of European Jews to establish a Jewish state, to establish a Jewish homeland where they would be free from the vile, deadly persecution of European anti-Semitism. Remember, this is Jews in Europe had been enduring deadly anti-Semitism for hundreds of years at this point, I mean, literally hundreds of years. And there was this sense among a lot of European Jews, particularly Eastern European Jews, that like we can't assimilate, we can't even convert to Christianity and be accepted. We need to get out and form our own state. And so at this time, they considered Uganda, to go to Uganda and set up this Jewish state there. They considered Argentina as a possible Jewish state, and Palestine. And because Palestine, as it was known then, was also held these Jewish holy sites, it made most sense. And there was a Jewish presence in Palestine. It made the most sense for them to establish this Jewish state in Palestine. I think one thing to keep in mind, this is the era of European colonialism. So this is the era where Europeans, British, French, Dutch, Spanish, Italian, etc., were in the mode of setting up new states around the world and saying, well, we need to do this, so we need some rubber, so let's colonize the Congo. And it was a little more complicated than that, but this idea of having the world to at their fingertips. In any case, the Zionist movement begins. It began as a secular movement among secular Jews in Eastern Europe, and then over the decades became a little bit more religious. This is a map of Palestine in 1878, before the Zionist movement began, and you might not be able to see the color differences here, but all of the red dots are Palestinian villages and towns, and the black dots, the big black dots, are mixed towns. So we can see Yaffa, Haifa, Jerusalem, Hebron, Safed, and Tiberias were mixed Jewish, Muslim, and Christian. All of the red dots were Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, and Christian villages. So I think what this map shows is just at this time, this was a predominantly Muslim and Christian, Palestinian land with a significant Jewish minority, particularly in the cities. Fast forward a bit, 1916, this is toward the end of World War I. The quote-unquote great European powers saw the Ottoman Empire crumbling and retreating in its territory, and so they got together and drew up this map to divide the Middle East. And their plan was to give what is now Lebanon, Syria, parts of Turkey to the French, Palestine, even parts of Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, to the British. And so it was literally this, like, French and English dudes sitting around a table saying, like, how are we going to divide this land up? In 1917, the Balfour Declaration. Remember I said the fighting really began around 1917. So the Balfour Declaration was a letter Balfour's first name. Arthur, thank you. Arthur Balfour to Lord Rothschild, who was part of the Zionist movement in Britain, promising that the crown, the British crown, would support this Zionist movement, would support the creation of a Jewish homeland. And Palestinians, this was not just a private letter, this was public knowledge. published, you know, in newspapers around the world. And Palestinians saw this as a threat. They saw this as, we are going to be like colonized people around the world, displaced, colonized, we're going to lose our homeland. At this point, the Zionist movement, you know, Zionist settlers were coming into this territory, and there were squabbles here and there, but it was a relatively peaceful coexistence between the European Jewish settlers and the indigenous Palestinians were there. But when the Balfour Declaration was made, Palestinians started seeing this as a threat, and this is where we start seeing attacks on Zionist settlements, counterattacks on Palestinians, and things got to be more violent. Not like a sustained period of violence, but violent clashes here and there. 1920, the Sykes-Picot Agreement becomes concretized in the ground, into law, and the British Mandate begins. And so this map, which is not exactly like Sykes-Picot, but took the spirit of it, divided Iraq, what was then called Transjordan, what we call Jordan now, and Palestine into British control, and Syria and Lebanon into French control. And this is why still to this day, if you go to Beirut, some kids are educated in French. A lot of people speak French, English, and Arabic, or French and Arabic. So we still see this legacy. But it was basically, the mandate was a form of colonialism, but with an end point in mind. So the idea was, the British are going to control this territory, but for a period of time until the Zionist movement is ready to create this new Jewish state. So in 1920, when the mandate begins, the colors aren't showing up too well here, you can see that there were more Zionist communities, colonies, settlements, whatever you want to call them. There were some independent ones. There's the new city of Tel Aviv, which bordered Jaffa, and today actually Tel Aviv has incorporated Jaffa into its city limits. And there were, you know, settlements here and there of European Jews in Palestine. 1942 to 45, as you know, was the heart of the Nazi Holocaust. The relationship between the Holocaust and Zionism and the establishment of Israel is something we could have a whole 3 years of lectures on, so I apologize for diminishing this to a bullet point, but this is absolutely essential to understand how, when, and why the creation of Israel happened. With the Nazi Holocaust, this, of course, did many things, and one of them is that survivors of the Holocaust, a significant number went to Palestine as part of the Zionist movement, a significant number went to North America. But this also, probably more than anything, created a sense among the British and the Americans that there was this need for a Jewish state, that there was a need to protect the Jews. And some people cynically said, well, this was kind of a movement of guilt, that like the British and the Americans felt guilty for not protecting the Jews from the Holocaust, and so they offered this state. 1947, the United Nations comes up with a partition plan to divide this place of Palestine, to create a Jewish state, to create this new state of Israel, and to create a Palestinian state for Arabs. And it looked like this, the map that they drew up. So the yellow parts would be the Arab state, Palestine, the orange would be the Jewish state, Israel, and Jerusalem and its surroundings would be administered by the United Nations as this international city open to all people and all religions. When this was presented, Palestinians rejected this. And they rejected this mostly because of this map. The Jewish population in Palestine still in 1947 was pretty small, relatively small. It was about 20% of the population. And if we look at land ownership, it was just these darker brown areas. And so what this map meant for Palestinians is that they were going to lose a disproportionate amount of their territory. They were going to lose farmland, homeland, and would be forced to flee to another, to this Arab state, this new Arab state, rather than being able to stay where they were. And so Palestinians rejected this. Nevertheless, in 1948, May 1948, the State of Israel is born, ratified by the United Nations, by the United States. And I should say, between this partition plan and the birth of Israel, a civil war broke out between the Zionists, the Palestinians, and the British. It was this sort of three-way conflict. The British fighting both Palestinians, but mostly the Zionists, and the Zionists fighting Palestinians and the British. 1948, the birth of Israel. This is known to Israelis as Independence Day, May 15th, 1948, and known to Palestinians as the Nakba, or the catastrophe. And it's known as the Nakba because this is the start of a massive loss of land, loss of population, what some historians have called ethnic cleansing, however you want to describe it. Palestinians are displaced, are moved out of this new state of Israel. At the same time that the new state of Israel is created, the surrounding Arab countries, most notably Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, invade this new state of Israel. And so this regional war starts all at once. And if you look at sort of the official histories of Jordan or of Egypt, they'll say, well, we were protecting our Palestinian brothers and sisters. And that might be true, but it was also kind of this opportunity of a land grab, of like Jordan expanding its territory and Egypt expanding its territory. This war did not end well for Palestinians or for the Jordanians or for the Egyptians. This is just the front page of the Palestine Post. State of Israel is born. The results of this war were many, and one was the basic borders of Israel that we know today. And so Israel attained the territory that was suggested to them in the UN partition plan, but also expanded this all the way to these kinds of borders here. And at the time, Jordan had control over what we now know as the West Bank. That's the West Bank of the Jordan River. And Gaza had control over, Egypt had control over the Gaza Strip. So a lot of implications here with this new state of Israel, with these new boundaries. One of them, and I think one of the most significant ones, are two different rights to return. So the United Nations, in UN Resolution 194, December 1948, declared that Palestinians who lost their homes could return, and not only could return, but they have the right to return to their homeland. So about 700,000, 750,000 Palestinians were driven from their homes in what the new state of what was the new state of Israel, and the UN declared right at the end of this fighting, like refugees anywhere in the world, they have the right to return to their homeland. This right has yet to be granted. Palestinians to this day live in UN-administered refugee camps. And this is one of the crucial points of conflict. Palestinians cannot return to their homeland. The second right of return is a Jewish right to return enshrined in Israeli law that was formed at the same time that the state was formed. And this is, I quote, "The state of Israel will be open for Jewish immigration and for the ingathering of the exiles." And what this meant and continues to mean is that any Jewish person anywhere in the world, if they are deemed appropriately Jewish by the Israeli government, can move to Israel and automatically become an Israeli citizen. Right, so it's this idea of returning to this ancient homeland of Israel. And so that this is why, you can, like I have friends who, when they were 18, flew to Israel and became Israeli citizens, by virtue of being Jewish and being there. It gets a little complicated because you can't just say you're Jewish. You have to trace your Judaism through your mother's side or be the right kind of Orthodox Jew. So I have a friend who actually converted to Judaism in her young adulthood, and she married an Israeli guy and wanted to become Israeli, and she could not become Israeli because she was not, she couldn't trace her Judaism through her mother's side, and she was not the right kind of Orthodox Jew. So, like I said, 750,000 Palestinians are expelled, and they are expelled to primarily the West Bank. So the West Bank actually today has thousands of Palestinian refugees. The Gaza, 70% of Gaza's population today are refugees from 1948 or the descendants of refugees. And then others went to Lebanon, to Syria, to Jordan, and a smaller number went to Europe and abroad. And I just have a short video clip that I wanted to put it in this, the words of a couple of Palestinian refugees. Let's see if that works. Might not. That would be a shame. There we go. You might not get that. Sorry about that. Actually, it might be loading. Well, at some point, it's probably going to like pop up, and you'll hear someone start talking. What's that? What is? Oh, thanks. Yeah, thanks. So this is from a documentary on the Nakba made by Al Jazeera, a multi-part documentary. Presumably this will come up. I'm used to working on a different kind of computer. Sorry.
المكتبات الهامة زي مكتبة السكاكين والنقول الزيادة وحتى المكاتب العادية وتؤخذ إلى حيث تودع اليوم في المكتبة الخاصة بالجامعة العربية في القدس.
منهج اللي تمتده المنظمات العسكرية الإسرائيلية في عملية التهجير. فالبصة كمثل تم حصارها وقصفها من ثلاث جهات وأبقيت المنطقة الشمالية مفتوحة. طبعا والشاطر يفهم المقصود إنه المنطقة الشمالية مفتوحة. شو بنقدر نوقع إحنا ضحايا بيكون منيح نعمل ترويع وتفويت للسكان. وهذا اللي صار مع أهل البصة إنه بنتيجة الحصار والقصف بالطائرات والمدفعية وعملية تهجير السكان صارت بالألم. اللي ما قدروا يهربوا تخبوا في كنيسة البصة. وبعد ما دخلت قوات الهجناء على البصة أخرجوا أربعة وتم قتلهم شباب وصبايا بجيل الـ14 والـ15 والبقية قاموا في تركيبهم. الهجرة تمت إلى لبنان لأنه تم قصف القرى والإغلاق عليها من ثلاث جهات. كذلك التهجير كان إلى سوريا من خلال محاصرة من ثلاث جهات والإبقاء على الجهة الشرقية الشمالية. فيما يتعلق في القرى الفلسطينية المحاذية لمنطقة الغور نفس الأسلوب. ومن هون تم خلق قضية اللاجئين من قبل المؤسسة العسكرية الإسرائيلية.
Could you all read that? I know it's kind of small. Okay. So, at the same time, in the same region, you have one group of people who are celebrating this safe, relatively safe passage from the Holocaust, from the anti-Semitic horrors of Europe, from their expulsion from Arab countries that was going on at the same time. and this creation of a modern state. While simultaneously there are people who have lost their homes, lost their lives, are driven out for what they thought would be 1 week, 2 weeks until the fighting died down, and to this day cannot return. And so I think like that moment in 1948 really encapsulates so much of this conflict, that this great achievement of independence, of freedom for one people was built on the backs of the expulsion of another people. So give you a picture of Palestinian refugee camps. As I said, they're in West Bank, Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. This is the Shatila camp in Lebanon outside of Beirut. I spent a lot of time in the Shatila camp there in Beirut. And if you want to learn more about that, among other people, Lila Richards worked as a surgeon in Ein El Hilweh, is that right?
Yes.
For a number of years in the 1980s. So, 1964, the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, is formed. This was the first organized Palestinian-led political military resistance to Israel. It was formed outside of Israel. It was formed, I believe, in Kuwait initially. And from this time periodically forward, the PLO would launch attacks on Israel, first primarily from Jordan and then later from Lebanon. And so the birth of Israel meant pretty soon after its founding that Israel would sustain these attacks from the PLO as well as some other militant organizations. 1967, you've probably heard about the Six-Day War. This is in June of 1967, where Israel goes to war against many, if not most, of its surrounding countries. So Israel goes to war against Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and to a lesser extent, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Lebanon. They sent troops. But this war, and again, this could be a whole year of study, was a war where Israel felt threatened by the Egyptian army, which had moved to the Israeli border. And so Israel launched a preemptive attack against Egypt. And then it erupted in this war. Lasted only 6 days. Israel was victorious very quickly, won the war, which was just seen by many people as this kind of David and Goliath thing because of the size of Israel and the size of these other militaries. It helped that Israel had the assistance of the United States military, not as much as it does now, but that was a factor. But in any case, the Six-Day War also led to the beginning of the Israeli occupation. I mentioned occupied Palestinian territory. This is where we start to see the occupation. And what this means is that as a result of the war, Israel took control of the entire Sinai Peninsula, so this is Egypt, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and the Syrian Golan Heights. And what it means to occupy, this is a legal classification, is that the Israeli military controls law and order here, controls the borders. Any sort of local authority that previously existed or local laws, unless it's approved and okayed by the Israeli government, the Israeli military, is meaningless.
Jerusalem.
Yes, thank you. Jerusalem, which under international law is part of the West Bank, part of the occupied West Bank. But yes, East Jerusalem. So the occupation cuts Jerusalem in half into east and west, and East Jerusalem, actually 48 cut it in half, but now Israel occupies East Jerusalem, which up to that point was mostly Palestinian inhabited. To this day, Israel continues to occupy the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. In 1978, I think it was 78 or 79, Israel reached a peace agreement with Egypt and gave up the Sinai Peninsula. And you might remember a couple months ago, I think, Donald Trump announced that the Golan Heights is part of Israeli territory, which was controversial because under international law, this is still occupied Syrian territory. And so for him to say this is Israeli territory, he's basically saying, to hell with international law, we're giving this to Israel. So 1973 was the October, sometimes referred to as the Yom Kippur War. This was a war where particularly the Arab countries that had lost land in 1967, Syria, Egypt, and Jordan, attempted to gain back their land. This was a brutal and bloody war for about a month, and there was a sense that Israel could lose this or could lose the territory. And this is the moment where the United States really opened its weapons cache and said, whatever you need, this we will provide. From this moment on to the present day, Israel has been giving, on average, about $3.5 billion of military aid to Israel. And so once the United States basically opened the doors to the most high-tech military equipment, this war quickly ended and Israel reestablished its control. 1979, sorry, I said 78 before. The Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty, brokered by not Dell, but Jimmy Carter. This brought Israel and Egypt to peace. This is a peace accord that stands to this day. After this peace accord was signed, the United States gave $1.5 billion of military aid to Egypt every year since this time. This was a gradual withdrawal, as you can see, up through 1982. They left the Sinai Peninsula. In the 1980s, Israel starts to settle its civilian population inside the West Bank and Gaza. Now, under international law, to occupy a country is actually not illegal. Like the United States, whether you liked it or not, or agreed with it or not, the United States occupied Iraq from 2003 to 2009. But under international law, it is illegal to settle civilians in occupied territory. Nevertheless, Israel started to settle its civilians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, giving them housing subsidies, you know, building all this infrastructure. And this is a process that has continued to this very day. I was in the West Bank, was that last year? And we saw the cranes, the construction equipment, building settlements just, you know, on a daily basis. This is just a picture of one of many Israeli settlements. Initially, they had red roofs because, according to an Israeli architectural historian, it was so that the Israeli Air Force would know which house is not to bomb. I don't know if that's a myth or not, but it is true that the early Israeli settlements had red roofs. Let me just show you a short clip so you can hear from an Israeli settler himself. This is from the...
Hi, my name is Petra Hess from PetraPix.com. I'm going to teach you a pattern that I have used to generate consistent profits for the last decade.
It turned out our trainer, Steve, was himself a settler who'd moved into the West Bank from South Africa. When we arrived at...
I don't know why you're not seeing that. Well, you can use your imagination. Just here.
This settlement, I was surprised to see it looked more like an American suburb than an outpost in a hostile territory. The community that you live in was built in the particular place that it was built because of the historic significance of the place?
Yeah, most of the little areas here that actually found signs of, you know, ancient Jewish settlement there. We feel that it's like reviving the past kind of thing.
Right. So you're saying your settlement is right on the right here, and some fields that are used by Palestinians are the left. Are there any sort of confrontations between the people working in these fields and people from your settlement?
Not often. Occasionally I have been called in to what we call a khadira, that's an infiltration. I've caught on a few occasions Arabs that have infiltrated the settlement. They come to steal. In my mind also, I think that's quite a clever way for them to gather information to see how quickly we react. They're taking all this information in, so we've got to be really alert.
Do you ever worry about your kids that they can get hurt?
I think every parent worries about their kids.
Would you ever question your decision to bring them out here in such close proximity to
not
people who aren't very happy with your presence?
No. I mean, like, I'll tell you.
It's not something you think about.
It's not something I think about.
It turns out the Israeli state has given his settlement and many others like it its full backing. But like most settlements, it hadn't started out this way. It was once an encampment that was considered illegal, even by Israel. But over the years, the settlers have learned that if they squat a site in the West Bank long enough, Israel will give them its approval, its infrastructure, and its security. You don't feel that coming here would provoke your enemies to violence?
I don't see why it should. Look, again, what I'm saying is that I don't think a draft taking other people's land. I don't think a draft for me means that I'm working hard. They've been working in these fields now for maybe two generations.
Yeah.
So just like that's maximum. When we're talking about Palestinian people, we're maximum talking about maybe 1.5 to 2 generations.
Yeah.
But these people have been here for 5,000 years. This dates back. You know, it's been there. It's 3,000 years ago. This was active and used. We're not just a fabrication that this is, oh, we want this place. You know, I understand that they were here for whatever reasons, were exiled out of Israel, but you know, we're given opportunities to come back.
Now, this was an incredible fabrication on Steve's part. The notion that the Palestinians had only lived on this land for two generations was totally false. But the idea that Jews had a historic claim to the West Bank's territories that trumped any Palestinian claims was one I'd hear over and over in the next few days. And turned out to be a major part of the settler ideology that ran directly counter to the two-state solution plan.
All right, that's just a taste. I still don't know why. I see something different than what you see. Anyway. So, 1980s, more settlers are starting to move into the West Bank and to the Gaza Strip at this point. So this is a map. I think this is from 2012, actually. The green areas are areas of Israeli settlers or land that have been controlled by the Israeli government for settlements or for military bases or that sort of thing. These are Jewish-Israeli settlements in Gaza. These were all evacuated by the Israeli military in 2005, so now there are no Israeli settlers in the Gaza Strip. But until 2005, from like the 80s to 2005, there were settlements. 1987 to 1993, a key moment in this conflict, the first Palestinian intifada erupts, meaning uprising. This was largely a grassroots movement started by teenage kids in Gaza, just fed up with being occupied, with being humiliated, with being detained, killed, and they just start protesting the Israeli military. A few kids were killed by Israelis in response to these protests, and then this just like erupted, this uprising. It was mostly nonviolent, not entirely nonviolent. It had everything left from people refusing to pay taxes. At this point, Palestinians had to pay taxes to the Israeli occupation, so they stopped paying taxes. People to this day Palestinians have to carry an ID card wherever they go. If they don't have their ID card, they'll be immediately sent to jail. People stop carrying their ID cards. It was illegal at this time to fly the Palestinian flag, and so women would hang their laundry in the colors of the Palestinian flag as a moment of resistance. Just like all of these different creative ways to resist. It also had some violent resistance. And a violent response from the Israelis. During this intifada, 1,376 Palestinians were killed, 94 Israelis were killed. This was also the birth of Sabil, which is the Palestinian Liberation Theology Movement. This is Asif's father, Naim Atik, and Chad Collins is going to talk about liberation theology and Sabil on August 6th, so tune in next time for that. But this is basically just a Palestinian Christians who saw what was going on around them, and they're reading the scriptures, and they're saying, okay, Jesus was living under Roman occupation and struggling against the political authorities. We're living under Israeli occupation, struggling against the Israeli authorities. It's not the same situation, but it's similar. And they saw themselves in this scripture. And this is really the birth of Palestinian liberation theology. 1993, the Intifada ends with the Oslo Peace Accords, brokered by Bill Clinton. People were very hopeful at this time. A lot of people were, both Palestinians and Israelis, that this was going to be the beginning of the end of this conflict. There was, you know, these sorts of coexistence gatherings of Palestinians and Israelis. There were just, you know, celebrations in the streets, not among everyone. A lot of people didn't really believe in this for a variety of reasons. The Oslo Peace Accords did something that stands to this day. They created three areas of the West Bank, areas A, B, and C. Area A are the red areas that have full control of the Palestinian Authority, which was this new Palestinian government created with the Oslo Accords. So to this day, there are, you can go to Jericho or Ramallah or Bethlehem and Hebron, and you'll see Palestinian police officers. The Palestinian law carries for the most part there. And then Area B was supposed to be under Palestinian civil control, like a Palestinian mayor, but Israeli military control, Israeli soldiers. And Area C was full Israeli control, so that's the green area. This Bill Clinton actually described this as the Swiss cheese model of a Palestinian state, so even he who brokered this peace agreement saw that this couldn't be the end of this conflict. This would have to be a step toward a full deployment or full redeployment of Israeli troops. And to this day, even though Palestinians are supposed to have full control over these cities, regularly the Israeli military will invade these places to arrest someone, to demolish a home, to sometimes just to put fear into the people. But you'll hear from Palestinians whether they're in Area A, B, or C, and it's almost impossible for a Palestinian to go anywhere in Area C, or if they do, they just risk arrest at any moment. In part, a failure, because of the failure of Oslo, the Second Intifada breaks out in 2000. This was a much more violent uprising. This is where some Palestinians started supporting suicide bombings. There were Palestinian attacks on Israeli civilian areas, markets, public buses, places where civilians were. If you talk to Israelis today, almost everyone knows someone who died in the Second Intifada. Or they know, I was late for my bus that day, and if I had been on time, it would have blown up. So it's very violent, bloody. This is also where the conflict starts to take more religious overtones. So Hamas starts rising in power here. Hamas actually was initially, I don't think it's fair to say supported, but prodded by Israel, because Israel saw them as a threat to the PLO. And so Israel wanted to see Hamas defeat the PLO. But in any case, Hamas rises in the Second Intifada. And nevertheless, the Israeli response was far more violent, far more deadly to Palestinians. So during this Intifada, nearly 5,000 Palestinians were killed by Israelis, including 2,200 civilians. 1,000 Israelis were killed, including 719. So we still see this grossly disproportionate amount of casualties. But for Israelis, this was sort of, for some Israelis, this was the first time the conflict really hit home and, you know, came into their spaces of work, of play, of their city infrastructure. And a lot of the sort of emotional scars of the Second Intifada, to say nothing of the physical scars, have not been healed. From 2000, from the Second Intifada to the present, Israel has intensified the occupation. I'm sorry if that's too small. I'll try to say it out loud. They increased settlements in the West Bank. So this is a map that shows 1970, there were actually very few Israeli settlements, and by 2016, they're across the West Bank, and if we had a 2019 map, it would be even more. This is just a map that shows these are islands of Palestinian habitation and relative control in the West Bank, and the rest is Israeli control. Israel also builds this separation wall, what they call the security fence. There's like 1,000 names for it. I think under international law it's called the separation barrier. It looks like this. It winds its way through the West Bank. This is just outside of Bethlehem, or in Bethlehem. There's lots of graffiti on the Palestinian side of the wall. If you go, if you take a trip to the Holy Land, like with a church, you'll probably go through one checkpoint going into Bethlehem. And on the Israeli side, number one, it doesn't look like a checkpoint. It's easier to pass through than a toll booth on the turnpike. And the wall is decorated, it's all landscaped, and there are all these signs that say, welcome to Israel, even though you're actually going into the West Bank. But on the Palestinian side, it looks a lot like that. This is a map. The green line is that border that was established in international law in 1948. The red line is where the wall has been built or is scheduled to be built. And so you can see it cuts deep into West Bank territory. And most of the time it's cutting into West Bank territory to surround settlements, like these big settlement blocks. But often it cuts into West Bank territory without anything in there except for Palestinian land. The Palestinians are evicted and then settlements are built in those areas. This has been declared illegal under international law, this wall. But it remains and continues to be constructed. We see the construction of Israeli-only roads in the West Bank at this time. So in the West Bank, there are all these roads that only Israelis can drive on. And the way they tell the difference is you have a different color license plate. And so they're like beautiful and paved and smooth. And then a trip from like Bethlehem to Jerusalem used to take 10 or 15 minutes. Now it can take about an hour and a half, 2 hours, if you're lucky enough to even have a permit to go to Jerusalem. If you're Palestinian.
You mean as a Palestinian?
Yeah, as a Palestinian. We also see the rise of checkpoints within the West Bank and on the borders of the West Bank in Israel. So this is a map of, these are Israeli checkpoints. So if you're traveling on these roads, you are stopped at the checkpoint. Sometimes you're let through, sometimes you're not. This is a little bit complicated, but let me try to simplify this. Everyone in this land, Israel-Palestine, has an ID. If you're Israeli, your ID gets you almost anywhere in this land, except for Area A. Legally, you're not allowed to go into Area A if you're an Israeli citizen, if you're a Jewish Israeli citizen. If you are Palestinian Israeli citizen, some people identify as Israeli Arabs, you can go almost anywhere in Israel and the West Bank. If you are a resident of Jerusalem, you can go basically anywhere in the West Bank in Israel, but you can only live in Jerusalem. And if you leave your home in Jerusalem for, forget what the length is, it's a pretty short amount of time, the Israeli government will confiscate your home and say, Jerusalem is not the center of your life. And the way they enforce this, they will go into people's houses, and I'm not joking, look through the refrigerators and their laundry to see if Jerusalem is indeed the center of their life. So in other words, they don't want someone who lives in Geneva for 9 months of the year and keeps a home in Jerusalem for 3 months a year. Or they don't want someone who has a home in Jerusalem and married someone in Ramallah to have to go back and forth between Ramallah and Jerusalem, even though the person in Ramallah legally can't go to Jerusalem. And if Jerusalem is deemed not the center of your life, you lose your home. I talked to a woman who, on Christmas Day, she's a Palestinian Christian, on Christmas Day, the Israeli government officials came into her home, searched through her laundry, searched through her kitchen to see if Jerusalem was the center of her life. So it's a very invasive policy. Most Palestinians have a green ID. A green identity card, which means they can only stay in the West Bank or they can go to Jordan, but they can never go to Israel. And in the West Bank, they can only go to areas A and B. And like I said before, if you don't have this green identity card with you, you'll be arrested. So you have to have this green identity card. For some people, they'll be given a permit to go to Jerusalem on Friday to pray. But they have to, you know, they have like a 2-hour window they can do that. For Christians, sometimes they'll give permits to Christians to go on Easter and Christmas to Jerusalem. But there are many Palestinians who have never been to Jerusalem before, even though they live, you know, what would be a 15-minute drive. And then Palestinians in Gaza, which I'll get to a little bit more in a bit. I am wrapping up, believe it or not. They can't go anywhere. They are stuck in Gaza. They cannot leave Gaza without extraordinary efforts to get out of Gaza. This is just a picture of what a checkpoint looks like. And keep in mind that so these men are going through the checkpoints every day to work in Jerusalem or to work in Israel. This is still a minority of the population who are lucky enough to have a permit to work in Israel or in Jerusalem. Most people don't even have that luxury to work, but they'll come every single day to pass through the checkpoint. These are women, you can see a baby. You know, babies have been born at checkpoints. People have died at checkpoints. And what I've learned from Palestinians whom I know, often they're humiliated even if they have all the right papers. An Israeli soldier will say, "Well, bark like a dog, you know, and have to bark like a dog. Well, hop on one leg, strip down your underwear," like usually in front of their kids to humiliate them even more, and then maybe they'll let them through, maybe not. Also, during this time, especially during the Second Intifada, but to this day, there are a lot of territorial sieges and home raids. So Israeli military will regularly go into Palestinian homes, will take someone they've suspected of throwing rocks or doing something more deadly. They'll also, if someone is suspected of committing an attack in a village, they will surround that whole village and won't let anyone in and out, in or out for days or weeks until they found the person that they'd like to get. We also see an increase in home demolitions, although this has been happening since 1948. This is yesterday in East Jerusalem. You may have heard in the news.
Yeah,
15 Palestinian apartment buildings in occupied East Jerusalem have been slated for demolition. They started demolishing, I forget if it's 15 of them so far, but they're scheduled to demolish all of them. Since 1967, about 50,000 Palestinian structures have been demolished by the Israeli military, usually almost always under the premise that it was built without a permit. About 99%, I'm not exaggerating, about 99% of applications for permits to build are denied. Right? So most Palestinians don't bother with all of that bureaucratic paperwork. They'll build in the West Bank. This is occupied Palestinian territory, mind you. And when a home is scheduled to be demolished, Palestinians have three options. One, they can demolish it themselves. Two, Israeli bulldozers, often Caterpillar bulldozers, will come and demolish it, but the Palestinians have to pay for the demolition of their own home. Or three, if they don't demolish it themselves and they don't pay for it, they go to jail. Right? And there's no, you know, it's not like, you know, I thought about this, like when East Liberty, when they demolished all those apartment buildings, which was a tragedy for a lot of people, they were given relocation assistance, right? And maybe it's still unjust and they shouldn't have been forced to move from their homes. There's no relocation assistance here. People are made homeless. And this just happens on an almost daily basis. If you read the Palestinian or Israeli news media, a Palestinian home is being demolished almost every day.
But then what about the mortgage? If they have a mortgage or something, the house isn't paid for and then it's demolished.
Yeah, that's a good question. I honestly don't know about how that would work with mortgages. Right. Yeah. Also, especially recently, but throughout this time, we see mass incarceration of children and adults. So we have children, Palestinian children, arrested by Israelis, hundreds of them every year. I'm going to show a short 1-minute video. Hopefully this will work. If we can't see it, then it's not going to work. Mm. All right. It's all in Arabic with subtitles, so sorry about that. I can send you the link. It just illustrates this is happening on our... What happened? Y'all are so smart. All right, this is just 1 minute. This is a video made by, I believe it's the American Friends Service Committee, along with Christian Peacemaker teams. Presumably that's going to figure. There's actually a bill in Congress right now, sponsored by Betty McCollum, to suspend United States aid to Israel in relationship to the detention of Palestinian children. I'm not saying that quite right, but it's a move to pressure Israel to stop detaining Palestinian children. Most men in the occupied West Bank have served time in Israeli prisons. Many are not given a charge. They're just in prison. Some it's for throwing stones. Some it's because they were at a demonstration, a rally. Some it's for, you know, things that we would consider crimes. But most men have served some time in Israeli prison. 2005, Palestinian Civil Society, a wide swath of Palestinian Civil Society, 180 organizations, call internationally for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel as a nonviolent move to pressure Israel into giving Palestinians their full slate of human rights. So this often gets left out of discussions of so-called BDS movement. There are three very clear goals. Palestinians are calling on the rest of the world to boycott Israel, to divest from companies that are profiting from Israel, the Israeli occupation, and to sanction Israel until the occupation is ended, Palestinians are given the right to return, and Palestinians within Israel are given equal rights. One thing I didn't mention is the Palestinian citizens within Israel are treated as second-class citizens. There's about 60 Israeli laws that explicitly discriminate against Palestinians within Israel. So this movement is launched in 2005. In 2006, Hamas wins legislative elections. A civil war breaks out between Hamas and Fatah, the other dominant political party, Palestinian political party. And Hamas takes internal control of the Gaza Strip, and Fatah takes control of the Area A in the West Bank. Israel launches a siege on Gaza in 2006 that has not ended to this day, which means the air, land, and sea borders of Gaza Strip are completely sealed off in cooperation with the Egyptian military. So nothing and no one can go into Gaza or out of Gaza without Israel's approval. Even Palestinian fishermen who earn their livelihoods as fishermen, I've been to Gaza City, I've seen the fishermen who start near these little boats, they are given these nautical limits. And if you've ever been in the sea before, there's no border in the sea, so you have to just know where this is. on an almost daily basis, Palestinian fishermen are shot by the Israeli Navy, almost daily basis. And this is a picture I took when I went to Gaza. I was able to get there through the UN. This is the passage between Israel and the Gaza Strip. It's about a mile long. And one thing you might notice there is no one's in there, because no one is passing through except for international journalists, international researchers, and aid workers. But Palestinians, it's almost impossible to leave the Gaza Strip or to enter the Gaza Strip. So many people I met described it as an open-air prison. It's one of the most densely populated parts of the world, and they're stuck there. I have a friend, actually, who managed to escape through a tunnel and is now in Turkey, but he's stateless in Turkey. And he has no rights at all in Turkey. So it's a really dire situation for Palestinians in Gaza. Meanwhile, Hamas has a repressive rule within the Gaza Strip. Israel's controlling Gaza from the outside. Hamas is controlling it from the inside. Hamas is far more conservative than Fatah. They, you know, like my friends, are like young people in their 20s in a lot of places. They like to listen to music and drink beer, and they couldn't do that under Hamas. That wasn't the only reason why they left. But anyway, Hamas are not really friends of the Palestinian people, although some people might disagree with me, but everyone I've met there did not like them. So during this time, Palestinians begin firing rockets from Gaza into Israel. This diagram shows you sort of the size of these rockets. They vary in size. This shows you the range that they can shoot into Israel. This is a picture of Hamas-affiliated militiamen shooting the rockets. These rockets, in reality, create some damage, but in order to kill someone, they really have to hit them directly. You can see, like, this is a damage to an Israeli home. This is a damage to an Israeli street from a Palestinian rocket. Nevertheless, Israelis don't like it when rockets are flying in the sky toward their homes. During the same time, 2006 to present, Israel is regularly invading the land of Gaza, destroying farmland, and bombing Gaza. And so this is what it looks like when Israel bombs neighborhoods in Gaza. And I've been to Gaza, I've toured these sites. So much of Gaza looks like this. 2008, a full-scale war breaks out between Israel and Gaza. 1,391 Palestinians are killed, including 759 civilians, 344 children. 10 Israelis were killed, 3 civilians. So some Palestinians don't refer to this as a war. They call it a massacre. 2009, the Palestinian Christians published Kairos Palestine and endorsed the BDS call. So every Palestinian Christian denomination endorsed this. You can download this off the internet. Just do a Google search on Kairos Palestine. It's a beautiful, scripturally based cry to the world. This is a Kairos moment. We need to act. They're calling on Christians around the world to boycott, divest from Israel as a nonviolent way of pressuring Israel. 2012, there's another war between Israel and Gaza. This was shorter. It was about a week or two. 167 Palestinians were killed. 6 Israelis were killed. 2014, this was the biggest war of the three. 2,104 Palestinians were killed, including 1,400 civilians and 495 children. 69 Israelis were killed, including 4 civilians and 1 child. So this is what I was talking about, like the disproportionate number of casualties. Again, it's up to you to decide whether it's just, but these figures are not really in dispute. All right, almost at the end. Right now, starting in March 2018 to the present, Palestinians in Gaza have been engaged in what they call the Great March of Return. This is a movement every Friday. Palestinians, particularly Palestinian refugees in Gaza, have been marching to the boundary between Gaza and Israel and protesting with the stated goals of returning to their homeland in Israel and ending the Israeli siege. Immediately when this started, Israeli soldiers, snipers, began opening live fire against the Palestinians, the vast majority of whom were unarmed. So more than 200 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli snipers, including 44 children, two women, four paramedics, and two journalists. 16,000 Palestinians have been wounded. This is something that often escapes the news. I mean, all of this escapes the news, but the Israeli military has been using these bullets that when they hit someone in the leg, it just shatters their entire leg bones. And so 16,000 Palestinians have been wounded, including 3,905 children. And one Israeli soldier has been injured in this uprising. Do you want to see a video, like 2 minutes, or do you want to? Okay. I know we're going a little longer than expected. Let's see if I can do this magic again. I'm pressing escape. All right, here we go. Okay, this is from an Al Jazeera report.
Anybody in UN human rights data says the police Israeli forces knowingly shot at journalists and health workers during the protests. Yasser Murtaja, who was filming a documentary about the protests, was shot in the abdomen and killed. 20-year-old medical Zahra Najjar was shot by a sniper bullet while she was wearing a white paramedic vest and trying to reach the wound. She was standing 110 meters away from the fence. Children and people with disabilities were also among the casualties. The UN says the actions of Israeli forces may amount to war crimes. Israel has accused Hamas of staging the protests.
There's been such an attempt to demean Palestinians and to dehumanize Palestinians that the fact that we have to respond to this is very sad. Palestinians seem so dehumanized that they paint everybody with this brush of Hamas. And then secondly, not only do they paint us with this brush of Hamas, they paint us as though somehow we are just puppets who don't really want to live, whose sole purpose in life is to simply try to undermine Israel. We are human. And the fact that I even have to say that we are human with dreams, with aspirations, with goals, who want to live, want to live freely, is saying a lot about the measures and the mechanisms that Israel has put into place to actually try to dehumanize it.
The protests have pushed for long-term ceasefire negotiations. The negotiations
there.
Within 15,000 Palestinians.
Okay. In conclusion, if I may boil this conflict down to a few bullet points. Palestinians generally want liberation from the Israeli occupation, the right to return to their homeland, equal rights for Palestinians within Israel. Some want two states, Israel, Palestine, two autonomous separate states. Some want a binational single state of Israelis and Palestinians, so a single democratic state. That's a debate. It's often generational. The younger folks are generally more in favor of a single binational state where Israelis and Palestinians would live in the same state. Israelis, generally speaking, want a state populated and controlled primarily by Jews. So this is what is meant by when Benjamin Netanyahu says a Jewish state. So not exclusively 100%, but a majority controlled and populated by Jews. And Israelis want safety and security. You remember that settler, and someone asked him, do you feel safe bringing your children here? And he said, well, of course I worry about my children. And so it's really, I think, the conflict is really the difficulty of reconciling these different aims, right? I mean, that's one way to look at it. But I think it boils down to that. So with that, I'll stop talking and open the floor to questions, comments, etc. Yes?
A history question.
Yes.
In 1948, the Israelis, they come in and they're taking over the state. Where did that government come from?
The new Israeli government?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the Zionist movement was very well organized, and so there were, you know, there were very well organized militias, political leaders. You know, it wasn't just like people coming off the boat and saying, "Let's create a state." It was,
okay, and
you know,
how did they reconcile in their own mind that they were just pushed out and killed all over Europe, yeah, and they could come down to another continent, to another country, and do almost the same thing to them? How did they reconcile that? I never understood that.
I'm not in that position, so I can't can't respond
to
that.
Have you ever heard anybody say how they reconcile that they were the persecuted ones, but they find it's perfectly fine to persecute another group of people?
Good question.
2 years later.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, excuse me. I think we should ask Native Americans what they thought about
that. I agree. I know that they
have
too.
Just a few things. One, in your timeline, Rob, I think we should include, I'm assuming, I think it's valid, that Israel has nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what year they, did they ever officially say that?
No, it's an open secret.
Well, we could include there, if there's a credible, some credible report, because I think that's significant. Secondly, does any, when I've had conversations with people and try to, if you were talking to a group of Jews and said, here are the statistics about the number of people killed, it seems to me, I mean, you piece them. But to see them all together in one flyer, and maybe that might exist somewhere, but to say, pretty obvious, but to line these up so that you can visually see, this is how many people were killed, Jewish, Palestinian, Israeli, and have it on one either piece of paper or one awareness so that you visually can see that, and it's hard to say it's not overwhelming. Because you just had them all scattered, I think having it one together.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think that exists, that sort of table. I want to humanize the conflict a little more. You know, I one thing I've heard from a lot of Palestinians is they say we're not numbers, we're not a number. So it's there's a little bit of that, but I take your point.
Also, if Israel and Palestinians are different percentages, you could say, you know, so many of this was killed and that, but it may be 1% of Israel's and 20% of Palestinians, which is a huge difference.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Somebody was asking, how could the Jews who had come from the Holocaust do the same thing to the Palestinians? My sister went to Palestine in 1974. Her husband was a Zionist, she just went along. But anyway, it was sold as a country without people. And they colonized they made an area that really bought from somebody and created a beautiful and productive community there. I myself went to Palestine, which soon became Israel, in December 47, after having survived the Holocaust in Germany. And it felt so good to be somewhere where you wanted to persecute it. And so you have to look at it from that perspective too. I am very, I feel terrible that all this had to happen at the expense of the people, the Palestinians. I at times was not aware of it, but it's just a different.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I think we also have to remember this is not exceptional. As Father Greg said, it's not much different than what happened in the United States with indigenous people, but also European colonization around the world. And so it's not like Israel is any better or worse than so many other modern nation states. Yes?
This Gaza being so sealed off, how do they keep producing rockets? From within, or are they somehow?
Yeah, that's a good question. There are tunnels that, like, I was talking to my friends, they're like, you can get anything through a tunnel. Like, you want drugs, it'll come through a tunnel. You want a cow, it'll come through a tunnel. The rockets are very crude, though. You know, it's not, we're not talking about high-tech weaponry. So, tunnels and ingenuity, I think. Yes?
So this just dawned on me. This is the first time I've really attended. You know, I didn't have a whole lot of knowledge of this, so this really helped a lot. But I'm kind of amazed, as you said, how much of like the United States story this is. And you know, looking for an answer, of course. I don't want to see an answer to this, but. You know, no matter how much peace work you do, there's always that reconciliation that needs to happen, and that's such a big thing. So that's just where
I'm thinking about. Yeah. Not an easy task.
I mean, well, even with the days of American Indians or the slaves that we used to build our country. You know, there's a lot of reconciliation that's needed up there.
And reparations.
And reparations. And not that many people are talking about it.
Right. Yes.
Could you restate these questions before you answer the question?
Oh, yeah, sure. Sorry.
There have been four questions. Just restate the question briefly before you answer.
Yeah, sorry. I can hear because they're saying them to me. She just asked about the connections between the way this country was founded and the way Israel was founded, and also just the difficulty and the need for reconciliation both here and there. Am I characterizing your point?
The need, the reparation seems to be the only kind of answer in my mind, but I don't see that happening, and also that in the United States anyways, there's not much talk about reparation and what those words say.
Reparation.
Reconciliation and reparation.
Yes.
My question wasn't related to your question, but the state of Israel is seen as reparations, right? So you kind of have to factor that into the equation. That's seen as reparations for what happened in New York Power. So that's some work to think. But my question was more an issue of property rights, right? Because I'm digging into this stuff and I'm saying, okay, well, how do they turn down somebody's home? I guess there's the Israel Land Authority, is that what it's called? ILA? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I'm not sure the exact agency. So I might
Well, I don't know if anybody knows anything about that, but there's this thing called the Israel Land Authority, which owns like 90% of Israel. And then I guess they give long-term leases to the Israelis, like 99 leases on it.
Right.
And so my question was, my thought was, well, can the Palestinians deserve any kind of land rights? And of course not, because I'm sure they don't get any. I'm sure they don't grant leases, right? Mm-hmm. Or if they do, it's still a lease, so you can just not renew the lease if you want to tear your house down, right? Mm-hmm. So, but I was wondering if you knew anything about the issue of property rights in Israel.
Yeah. Right? Did everyone hear that?
Yeah.
Okay. I know that there are Israeli lawyers who do fight in the courts for Palestinian land rights.
Okay.
You know, for the right to stay in their home, for example, or the right to build. And they're working really hard to do that. The victories are few and far between.
Sure.
And I'm not a lawyer, much less an Israeli lawyer, so I don't know the legal mechanisms,
sure.
But there is a legal system there, and people are trying to work the system. I mean, in a way that anyone...
But this seems like a very different... See, we're used to this country. Like,
fine.
You talk about the same Missouri.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, there's people renting, and they don't own the property, so
right.
They decide to change your mind about what you want to do with it, and you have to deal with that. Where over there, it's very different. They don't. Most people, I guess, Jewish or not, don't own their own property, at least it, from the government. Apparently.
Yeah.
So it's a very different. I mean.
Yeah.
Well, after 1948, when they basically debombed all these villages,
they created something called the absentee property law.
Okay.
Where if you're absent, they own your property.
They take it, yeah.
Yeah, and then they lease it to Jews only.
Sure.
And then there's an organization called the Jewish National Fund. They own a lot of property.
Right.
And by law, they're not allowed to lease or even rent an apartment to a house.
Wow.
All these settlements in new urban cities,
sure,
they're a Jewish one.
Sure, sure.
Thanks. Yes, in the back.
I have a question. I've often been puzzled that Israel was a very progressive country in the 60s. They had a good system. They had some great things. I read this story about Martin Buber, who was a Jewish thinker that I really respect. And I understand even he's someone who's influenced Christian thinkers. I understand his family took land from Palestine. And it's just like a cognitive dissonance about the values that the people in Israel have on the one hand. And the practice of tribalism, the fear of annihilation, it's just so deep that these values no longer function.
I mean, I think it goes back to what you said, that a lot of folks, number one, are just thrilled to be in a place where they feel like they belong, and number two, they don't know that this was someone else's land. Just like I don't know the actual indigenous people who are on my land. I know it was Haudenosaunee generally, and you know, you could say like maybe I should give up my place here as well, and that's not to justify it, but I think, yes.
But were there so many settlers from Europe and the globe that wanted to live in Israel, the new Israel, that forced the displacement? Was there enough land for both to cohabitate? I mean, it seemed like years of cohabitation, relative peace. They managed a society that was integrated to the degree it did. What happened? Were there a flood of settlers that forced that? It was just so many that you had to have that land?
So that's a good question. There's a great book by an Israeli historian, Ilan Pape, called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. And he goes through Israeli government documents. Benny Morris also has written a book like this, another Israeli historian, to show that it was in the Zionist plans to eliminate the indigenous Palestinian population.
But there was no reason other than that intention.
Right, to create a majority Jewish state. Right.
Is it because they felt so threatened by what they were through?
That could be, yeah. I mean, it was the idea, like, we've been a minority in every country we've lived in.
We have to be actually violent to keep what we need because it was taken from us.
Yeah, maybe. But, I mean, even a lot of the process of displacing people initially before 48 was just piece-by-piece land purchases. And then it also became violent. But to answer your question, It was part of the plan from the beginning. Just like in the United States, there were explicit plans to extinguish the indigenous population.
And the human cost, they knew what the human cost would be in that action, obviously.
Presumably, maybe. Yes.
So, I'm not an Israeli, I'm an American, so in classic self-centered fashion, I have a question about American policy. What would happen, just like sort of in the pretend hypothetical world where like I personally get to control the U.S. budget and I say I'm not giving military financially to Israel until the occupation of the West Bank stops, right? So that's my choice because I'm the budget fairy. What happens as a result of that decision?
That's a good question.
Globally. I don't care about individual people that much.
Well, I mean, this was a question that South Africans asked during apartheid. What happens if we end apartheid? What happens if American, and it wasn't exactly the same situation or relationship, but what happens if the United States stops supporting the apartheid government? And there were South Africans who were like, oh my God, we'll all be slaughtered. It'll be the worst thing ever. So, I mean, those questions have been asked in other situations. But I don't know. I mean, I don't have an answer to it any more than you do.
The answer could be be like, I don't know, maybe the British step in.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And like, fill that role. Like, if the U.S. doesn't do this, is someone else going to do it?
I've heard, one scholar said the Russians would be there in a second, in a heartbeat. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. Yes?
I don't know a lot about this, but there's more about a movement in Israel, a peace movement, that it's not as if all the citizens of Israel think that it's a good idea to persecute Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And there is a pretty strong peace movement there. But unfortunately, Netanyahu is not part of it. I mean, he's a good friend of our president, and I think has the same attitude about minorities.
Yeah.
So unless that movement is able to elect somebody who has a bigger view, and when we talk about South Africa, I think, well, they have Nelson Mandela. You know, and because of having somebody in a position of leadership who has a broader idea about people living together, then I don't know. But I think it's important to realize and to recognize that there is a strong movement in Israel. It's not just like four people.
Right, yeah, I think it's important. There is this peace movement. It has been for quite some time. Unfortunately, it is diminishing, and certainly diminishing in political power. Like a lot of places, the Israeli government is moving further and further right. Like, Netanyahu is not even on the right wing in the spectrum of Israeli politics. And so there is that. There's an Israeli committee against house demolitions. There's a group boycott from within. There is an Israeli peace movement, yeah. Unfortunately, they're getting squeezed. Yes.
That's you're right. A geographer, but you've titled this historical geography, and I wanted to piggyback on Mary's question, that really we're dealing with a time period in which it's unprecedented that a state or a kingdom that is Israel has this kind of imperial sponsorship. I can think of only three other times that there's independence. The Hasmonean rule, when there was a measure of independence. Some have even said that the Old Testament's claims about David and Solomon are hyperbole and not necessarily based in history, but we're really dealing with an unprecedented time since 1948 that there's been an imperial sponsorship of a state. Would you agree with that, with your historical side, or would you say no, that that's too general and needs to be nuanced?
I think I would answer, I'm not sure. That sounds like a reasonable hypothesis.
I mean, it's not only the $3.5 billion military aid, I think there's $12 billion other aid that's not necessarily designated that the Israeli government gets from the United States government.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's $12.5 billion annually, and of that, $3 or $4 billion is the military.
Yeah. Yeah. So that might be true.
A more legitimate comparison might be the Crusader kingdoms that were established during the Crusades that were backed by the Pope and by Europe, by various Christian princedoms, and it kept alive that way until they were finally dwarfed by wars from surrounding countries and forces. It was the same idea of the God has told us to establish this kingdom. We are going to redeem the people of Israel, of Jerusalem, bring Christianity back to Jerusalem. Some people have compared Israel to a Crusader kingdom.
Maybe. Yeah. Sorry, anyone who hasn't spoken or asked a question yet? Yes.
I wanted to point out that we're talking, in addition to the fact that Israel, by a factor of at least 10, maybe 100, is the largest recipient of military aid of any country in the world. So in addition to that, there is a recurring effort in the federal government to adopt legislation that will characterize boycott, divestment, and sanctions as hate speech, and therefore eliminate that as a possibility. I liked what you had to say about the summary of what boycott, divestment, and sanctions is about, because our Jewish friends will say the sole purpose of boycott, divestment, and sanctions is to eliminate the state.
Right. I don't think we can place that on our Jewish friends, because it's our Christian friends who are saying that more than anyone else.
Oh, okay.
And I think Jewish population is split like any population. But you're right. Whoever says it, it's often demonized and characterized as, yeah. Yes.
But I don't understand. The Palestinian Christians support BDS. Mm-hmm. What impact does that have on the American Christian Church? Mm-hmm. Don't they see that as is there a recognition of the Christians there supports it?
That's a good question, and there is, for many people, there are churches and denominations that have responded directly to that Palestinian Christian call, but there are many others who either don't know or they'll dispute the veracity of that claim.
I mean, it must have really shocked you that we never hear about that.
Yeah.
There's a strong fundamentalist Christian support.
Right.
For Israel.
Yes.
I just want to add, in your timeline, in addition to when did they get the nuclear weapons, to perhaps include when did Jimmy Carter say, call Israel an apartheid nation? I think that he said that or wrote it in a book to include that. Number two is when... I'm assuming to an extent from the responses here that this is kind of preaching to the choir, so to speak. Now, if to try to understand, some of you have alluded to this, if you had a group of Jewish folks over here, how is there some, has anybody, sure, groups have tried to do that, to say, this is what I see, this is what you see. It might be an argument between a husband and wife. Husband sees it this way, the wife sees it this way. How do you try to, you know, and efforts to try to bring some communication to look at? And that's why I think, for instance, those statistics, to be able to graphically see the numbers and say, okay, if you're Jewish, it looks obvious. If you were having a fight with your children, and one of them is 6'2" and the other one is 4'3", right. Obviously the one who's 6'3" is going to beat up the one who's 3'4". So, I mean, just to try to bring some...
Yeah, so I think it's a good point. Again, though, I want to shy away from characterizing, like, the Jewish people as seeing things one way and us in this room as seeing another thing. There's no monolithic Jewish community. But I hear your point about whoever they are, there are people who are going to see things differently. And that might be because they choose to see things differently or they've been taught differently. I think this is why education is really important. Our self-education and educating others. And going there, and going to Palestine. Yes?
Somebody was mentioning the peace movement in Israel. Mm-hmm. But we have a peace movement here in the United States. How successful are we?
I did not hear what
you said. Sorry, she said someone mentioned that there's a peace movement in Israel. But there's a peace movement in the United States, too, and it's not very successful. Yes, you had a question.
I want to be conscious of the time, so just briefly, could you speak to, and I trust I'm saying this right, your thoughts on board membership and the mission?
Yeah.
The sense of you and why you're there?
Sure. So I mentioned Sabil. It's Palestinian Christian Liberation Theology grassroots organization that is really focused on ending the Israeli occupation, on bringing equal rights for Palestinians, and doing so rooted in Christian theology and doing so in a nonviolent way. The Friends of Sabil North America is a solidarity organization initially specifically with Sabeel, and now it's more broadly in solidarity with Palestinian struggles for equal rights. But our mission, you can go on the website, I don't know it word for word, but it's similar to the Sabeel mission, that we strive for peace, justice, and equality, and in doing so, do it through Christian principles. Is that kind of...
Yeah, your personal...
Oh, well, that's a longer story, but... yeah, I mean, I think I lived in Beirut, and I spent a lot of time in Shatila, in the Palestinian refugee camp there, and I knew nothing about this at that point, or very little, and just meeting so many people who've been living in exile for their whole lives, that inspired me to learn more. And I think in seeing what the church, the Presbyterian Church, has done in response to this, brought me back to the church, and I saw that, you know, my church that I grew up with is not just about singing hymns and sitting quietly every Sunday, that there are folks who do things in the spirit of the prophetic tradition of making peace and justice. So that's what inspired me.
It's called what it is. Buttressing white supremacy.
What the church does is buttress white supremacy.
Keep asking questions, because people are going to have to leave. You're gradually, I just point out that we have a little store back here where we're selling Palestinian olive oil from the West Bank.
Earth Pressed.
And some other memorabilia. You have a free sample of olive oil. And so take a look before you leave.
Yes, Tom.
I'm without a car tonight. If anybody is going like the direction of Monroeville, Churchill, and else, would appreciate an insult.
Did everyone hear that? He needs a ride home. If you're going in the direction of Monroeville, give this gentleman a ride.
Yes. I also just wanted to mention regarding Sabeel, 2 weeks from tonight, same location, same time, we've got a program with Reverend Chad Collins is going to be speaking about Sabeel on Palestinian liberation theology. So a chance to get a little bit more information about that in depth.
Just want to say, again, I'm not saying anyone needs to come on church to do that. when Brother Tom had reached out to Bob and me to do something like this, Bob had the wonderful insight to say we should give some historical background before we talk about Palestinian liberation and theology. So I don't know how you felt, but I think we should give Bob a round of applause. It's really a wonderful foundation. Obviously, there's more to learn about the history, but I think Bob really gave us something that was really cool. And so, and I know that there are some emails signed up, and I think if anybody would want the PowerPoint, you'd be willing to share, is that right?
Yeah.
With instructions on how to do it?
Yeah. Chad, would it be helpful to read the Kairos document in preparation for your presentation?
That would be helpful, whether you come to the presentation or not. Yes.
And also, one other thing is we've recorded the Bob's talk, and depending on the quality, if it comes out, we'll try to post it on six website, and people will be able to listen to it again. And maybe if Bob would also share a PowerPoint presentation, we can post that on the website.
Sure. Yeah. Be happy to. Okay. All right. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Oh, my gosh. Thank you for your contributions. I really appreciate it. Sorry.